The Bob Siegel Show, sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but these days, especially amidst all the talk about God blessing America, the 4th of July, American patriotism, you keep hearing reminders that America has a stained heritage of slavery. In fact, you even question the Judeo-Christian principles our nation is based on because you've heard that the Bible itself is a book that promotes slavery. How can we believe in a God who promotes slavery? My friend, I would sympathize with your concern if it were true, but it's not true. The Bible does not condone slavery. As a matter of fact, the Bible condemns slavery. The very abolitionists that inspired our own Civil War, which freed the slaves. Yes, America did something about slavery. A bloody war which freed the slaves. We need to include that in the narrative too. These very abolitionists who inspired the war backed up their anti-slavery convictions with the Bible. And around 100 years later, the Reverend Martin Luther King in his march on Washington to obtain further civil rights also quoted from the Bible. We will discuss the Bible and slavery later on in today's program. We will also discuss America and slavery, a big topic in the news again. Of course, there is a lot of other news these past few days. There are geological earthquakes in California and a lot of the usual political earthquakes, such as the criticism Donald Trump garnered for his special 4th of July speech and celebration. In point of fact, long before he gave the speech, his critics from the Democratic Party, MSNBC and CNN, gave commentary on the speech. Yes, commentary on a speech they had not yet heard. In fact, MSNBC didn't even broadcast the speech. We did, however, get to hear their analysis. I'm so grateful they're on hand to filter the news for us, explaining what Trump means instead of encouraging us to actually listen to what he says. Much to the disappointment of his enemies, the president's speech was not self-serving. It was very unifying. Even the Washington Post, no conservative paper by any means, even the Washington Post opinion said Trump made his critics look small during his salute to America. Vox was also honest. That's Vox with a V, not to be confused with Fox. Vox was honest, but they still had to get in a little dig. Here's one of their headlines. Trump's salute to America speech wasn't as bad as some feared, but it was still weird. Now, part of the weirdness they refer to is what Trump talked about with airports regarding the Revolutionary War. Naturally, the patronizing press is pointing out that airports didn't exist in colonial days. No fooling? They didn't have airports in colonial days? Get out! We had no idea! Wow! I'm so glad these people are around to enlighten us. Okay, look, Trump claimed that was a mistake from the teleprompter. That sounds like a reasonable explanation. Love Trump or hate Trump, does anyone seriously think the man believes we had airports during the Revolutionary War? Seriously? Give me a break. Now, we talked about gaffes last week. Everybody makes them. I make them. You make them. Joe Biden is a perpetual gaffe machine. He wrote the book on gaffes. So talk about Trump. Well, excusing Biden is just a tad bit disingenuous. I mean, who are we kidding? Back to the claim that Trump did this to be political and turned it into a Trump rally. It did not even remotely resemble a Trump rally. Here's a selection of the president's speech on the 4th of July. Together we are part of one of the greatest stories ever told, the story of America. It is the epic tale of a great nation whose people have risked everything for what they know is right and what they know is true. It is the chronicle of brave citizens who never give up on the dream of a better and brighter future. And it is the saga of 13 separate colonies that united to form the most just and virtuous republic ever conceived. On this day, 243 years ago, our founding fathers pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to declare independence and defend our God-given rights. Thomas Jefferson wrote the words that forever changed the course of humanity. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. With a single sheet of parchment and 56 signatures, America began the greatest political journey in human history. Now, that's only part of the speech, but most of it was just like that. Now, on the other hand, let's look at a few speeches given about Trump on the 4th of July by his Democrat rival candidate. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said the 4th of July event was a waste of money. You know, he's having a parade for himself, putting tanks out there for himself. As if he really cares about the men and women of our nation, he would be investing in higher pay, better housing, better health care. Senator, you do realize that without the military, we would not have won the War of Independence, and we would not be celebrating Independence Day, right? Just something to think about. And Trump has fought more for veterans' rights than any other recent president. Just something else to think about. Representative Tulsi Gabbard said that the event dishonors our troops, dishonors our service members and veterans, because it's really all about Trump. It's not about our service members. It's not about their sacrifice. It's just not about my brothers and sisters who lost their lives in service to this country. And that's the most unfortunate thing. As for Joe Biden himself, you know, I try to listen to Joe's comments when he makes them. I really do. But then he speaks. And here's what he said about Trump and the 4th of July. What I wonder, will Donald Trump say something this evening when he speaks to the nation at the event designed more to stroke his ego than celebrate American ideals? Ladies and gentlemen, let's just be careful. On a so-called concern that President Trump was turning the 4th of July into something political and self-serving, our mature, thoughtful, balanced, nonpartisan Democrats were just about as divisive, self-serving, and political as they could possibly be. For myself, I don't mind being divisive, 4th of July or otherwise. My only criteria for speech is not whether it's going to be divisive, but whether it's speaking the truth. So you'll indulge me for a moment as I call out the Democrat candidates as the power-hungry, narcissistic, lying weasels that they are, totally void of genuine conviction, with no opinion whatsoever unless it's first tested by polls and focus groups, each in a race to move further to the left of their rival candidates, just for now, just to win the nomination in the hopes of lying to us about being more in the center later on should they gain the nomination. Promising more for illegal aliens than American citizens. Caring more about keeping the planet green than keeping babies alive. That's the Democratic Party. And that's as true on the 4th of July as it is any other time of the year, so we may as well just say so. It is amazing to see the kinds of matters that concern the left and the kinds of matters that do not concern the left. A high school boy wearing a MAGA hat is caught on camera smiling at a man who is practically chanting in his face. The media goes ballistic. A conservative journalist is literally beaten up by Antifa thugs who say in their name that they are against fascism, even though they use fascist tactics to suppress anyone who dares to disagree with them. Where now is the outrage of the mainstream media? It is rather fleeting. Of course, that story immediately took a back seat last week to Nike. Yeah, Nike. Nike pulls its latest shoe with a picture of the original 13-star American flag after the hero, Colin Kaepernick, complains that the flag symbolizes slavery. I suppose Kaepernick's socks showing cops drawn as pigs is more appropriate. more appropriate than a flag which stands for the kind of freedom that eventually freed all slaves. A flag in which many of the represented original 13 colonies had already abolished slavery and tolerated the slave states only because they were needed to break from England, the idea being let's fight one battle at a time. And we have been told that this flag would have distracted the celebration of 4th of July. Of course, the celebration of our freedom is obstructed by our flag, which stands for the exact same freedom. Welcome to the age of idiocy. But idiocy is easier to excuse than cowardice, such as the actions of a company like Nike caving into this blowhard whose own experience in America made him a wealthy celebrity. And for doing what? For playing a game that people pay to see. Nike wants us to believe they aren't caving. That instead they didn't understand that this would be an earlier edition of the flag. Sure. Of course. That explains everything. A company the size of Nike was unaware of their own product until days before it was scheduled to come out. But I hope a lot of people believe them. If so, I have land to sell them on Mars. Unless talk about new colonization is also racist. This popular narrative that our flag or forefathers should be disrespected due to slavery is propaganda. It is a half-truth. Yes, we once held slaves in our country, but let's back up for a moment and examine this honestly. The very word slavery at once produces images of shame and pride. We can be proud of the many Americans who either dedicated their lives or sacrificed their lives to eventually ending this horrific institution. We also shudder to think that a wicked, inexcusable mistreatment of people could ever have been allowed by our country at all. American history is a paradox. On one hand, the word hypocrisy seems almost too obvious a description for our nation forged upon premises of freedom, all the while embracing the most opposite idea to freedom ever witnessed. In the mind of any decent thinker, nothing could be more abhorrent than human beings, actually buying, selling, and owning other human beings. On the other hand, much as idealistic individuals hate to admit it, life can often be a series of contradictions and ethical inconsistencies. 21st century citizens, with their 20/20 hindsight, find 18th century moral paradoxes difficult to fathom. As a result, they dive into conversations of conscience with simplistic thinking. But the legacy left behind by our founding fathers is simplistic only in its ideals, and we'll talk more about these ideals when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
America is a country with a history of slavery. America is also a country that has a lot of ideals in its history. The legacy left behind by our founding fathers is simplistic in its ideals. The accomplishment of these ideals came into being like a long three-act play, one where the protagonist had to deal with a few demons of his own, unable to quickly slay dragons with his shining armor. American history is both wonderful and horrible at the same time. People often embrace the record they were exposed to at first, forgetting to play its flip side. We have the luxury of living at a time when verbal condemnation of slavery was one of the first lessons taught by grade school teachers. Earlier generations were offered a strikingly different presentation of this peculiar institution. They were taught that any people at all in those days who rose above such brainwashing to fight the practice were to be admired, even if they moved more slowly than molasses. Men like John Adams were quite vocal against slavery and said with passion, "Never in my life did I own a slave." Between the years 1777 and 1804, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, and New Jersey either abolished slavery or passed laws setting into motion its eventual demise. These decisions were not made in a vacuum and were partially influenced by our founding fathers. The new states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin joined the Union slave-free as a result of standards put in place earlier for the Northwest Territory during the Ordinance of 1787, inspired by Rufus King, one of the Constitution's signers. Founding fathers involved with societies for ending slavery include Richard Bassett, James Madison, James Monroe, John Marshall, and many more. Nevertheless, skeptics love to remind us of founders who spoke against slavery yet owned slaves themselves some their entire lives. Indeed, the much-admired Ben Franklin owned servants but changed his views on slavery as he grew older and helped to establish the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. Thomas Jefferson tried unsuccessfully through the Continental Congress to pass a law ending slavery and also penned some famous words, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free." Unfortunately, Jefferson found himself unable to personally break from the practice in part because of its financial trappings. Personal writings reveal that the man was tortured over his own inconsistency. Similarly conflicted, George Washington remained a slave owner his entire life, but also worked against the importing of new slaves into American colonies and eventually vowed to never again buy or sell a slave. Finally, Washington arranged for the release of all personal slaves at the time of his death and of his wife's death. Such self-reflection and growth cannot be overestimated. Our human conscience tends to hide on the mind's back shelf when bombarded by popular accepted practices of society. A typical ancient Roman, if asked how he felt about murder, would have condemned it without hesitation. But if he was asked about the gladiator games, his very same citizen might have offered a completely different answer and a puzzled expression, since in his mind, the gladiator fights were mere sporting events. Likewise, an American today, if asked what he thought about punching people in the face or beating people to a pulp, would immediately disavow such practices, even though he might hold tickets to a boxing match that night. America today, having long since settled its position on slavery, remains sharply divided over other matters of conscience. The jury is still out on how future generations will look back at us. One such issue, the red-hot topic of abortion, serves as an interesting analogy. Now, you may currently ascribe to a pro-choice position. If so, I respect your view. Yes, I said I respect you, provided, and it's a very important provision, provided you sincerely believe the unborn fetus is something less than a life. If you believe it's a life, you have a lot to answer for. But if you believe it's not a life, well, I disagree with that. I could disprove that. But if you believe it sincerely, I would take that into consideration. Meanwhile, many who once defended a woman's right to abortion are now leading activists in pro-life organizations, having concluded that the unborn child, even at an early state, is in fact a living person, not mere tissue or the property of another human being to be kept or disposed of at will, simply because it resides inside the mother's body. As a matter of fact, countless testimonies of key women who take on such cases reveal how they once had abortions themselves. Does such personal history make them hypocrites, or instead people who rethought a moral situation based upon their own experience? Our joint pilgrimage as human beings includes the marvelous ability to learn, grow, and eventually change. This is also true for countries. Slowly but surely, the high ideals of our founding fathers have been put into more consistent operation. If some historians made the mistake of painting these men as saints, just as many are mistaken to paint them as devils. They were, in fact, human beings, nothing more and nothing less. Let history reflect them accurately. Now, at the top of the program, we talked about the common accusation that the Bible itself promotes slavery. Why do people say this? Because if you take the Bible out of context, and I know you hear me say this a lot, if you take the Bible out of context, you can make it say anything. Now, slavery did exist in biblical times, and there were people who converted to Christianity, some as slaves and some as masters. And we do in several places, but I'll read one of them to you in Ephesians 6, 5 through 9. We do see some disturbing words. Now, we're going to look at the context of them, but let me look at these disturbing words first, because they are here in the Bible. This is the Apostle Paul talking to the church of Ephesus. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is a slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. Okay, so Paul does tell slaves to obey their master. So I can understand if somebody read this verse in the New Testament, and it was the only one they had read, or one of the only few they had read, they'd say, well, obviously, the Apostle Paul condoned slavery. The problem is, that's not the only thing the Apostle Paul wrote. He actually condemned slavery. Okay, question. If he condemned slavery here, then why is he telling slaves to obey their masters there? Well, there must have been an extenuating circumstance. But before we examine that extenuating circumstance, let's look at some of the places where he condemned slavery. 1 Corinthians 7, 21 through 22. Now, in this passage, there were a lot of people who had just become Christians, and Paul was of the view that persecution was coming. And he was telling people to remain in the situation they're in. He's saying, this may not be the best time to get married and start a family. And also, some of you were already married, and your spouse, when you became a Christian, your spouse didn't get saved, and they've left you, and now you want to go chasing after them. It's not really the best time to do anything like that either. He's telling people to remain in the position that they were called. And in that vein, he's talking about whether or not they were in a slave position when they got saved. And he says, well, we'll talk about what he says just as soon as we get back. This is the Bob Siegel Show saying, no, the New Testament does not favor slavery, but yes, it must be looked at in context. Thank you. is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Bob Siegel's novel, Push the Winds Around, is now available in both ebook and print copies. Check out this customer review from Amazon.com. Talk about a good read. Have you ever thought, if only God would allow me to go back in time to right my wrongs? What if I could change those decisions I made? What would be the outcome? Would the changes make a difference? If you have ever thought about that, then this book is your challenge. The story is so good you won't want it to end. You'll see why it deserves 5 stars. Bob Siegel, you've done it again. Can't wait for the sequel. Push the Winds Around, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
The 96.1 FM, 1170 AM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Before we return to our discussion, if you'd like to weigh in on any of the things we've talked about today, you can always reach me on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. Regarding what I said about Nike and Colin Kaepernick, Steve says, well said, Bob. Ree says, sickening, really. I couldn't care less what that idiot thinks. Why does anyone else? Brandon says, I hope Nike is happy that they traded 15 to 20% of their customers permanently to gain 5% woke customers who will maybe buy shoes once, then go back to hating them because they are a major corporation that uses cheap and probably underage labor. Well, actually, Brendan, I'm hearing that Nike is doing okay financially despite this. Time will tell if that continues. Either way, that to me is not the issue. The fact that they are spineless, that's the issue. Regarding Antifa beating and my comment that the mainstream media is rather fleeting in covering that story, Bonnie says fleeting, non-existent if conservatives are harmed. Fran says, I believe these events are catalysts to what's coming. I'm inclined to agree, Fran, sadly, but I'm inclined to agree. Bill says, I've heard that the young man who stood his ground when the Native American chanted in his face has a major lawsuit and will be a very wealthy man very soon when the media plasters his image on international television with no regard whatsoever, making him out to be a racist, quote-unquote. They must be brought to justice. Perhaps the young man will just take CNN and turn it into a cartoon channel. That's been the case for quite some time anyway. Okay, we're talking about a very interesting subject today. You'd be amazed at the kinds of things that the Bible gets accused of. The Bible is accused of being a racist book. The Bible is accused of being a book that promotes slavery. The Bible is accused of being a book that promotes rape. I was in a debate one time, and of course my opponent was being kind of disingenuous because during his closing statement, when you want to say something, you know, controversial, you're supposed to say it earlier in the debate so that your opponent has a chance to give a rebuttal. You're not supposed to bring up something new in your closing statement. You're supposed to just summarize in your closing statement. But in his closing statement, he makes this outlandish comment that the Bible promotes rape. And of course, I wasn't supposed to be allowed to say anything. However, they did have an audience Q&A time, so I just prayed that somebody would ask me the question. And somebody did ask me the question. Well, he was talking about this story where some angels went to get Lot and his family out of the city of Sodom. and a bunch of men were banging on the door saying that they wanted to rape those male guests. And Lot said, no, don't do this. Don't do this to my guests. I'll give you one of my daughters to rape instead. Okay, that was a horrible thing. So he says, well, see, the Bible's promoting rape. Well, no, I got up. I said, that is merely a report of what Lot did. The narrator there in the Bible isn't supporting what Lot did or commending Lot for doing it. It is merely a report of what Lot did. What Lot did, what Lot said, was heinous. And so this is an example of how the Bible can be taken out of context. And of course, our topic du jour today is slavery. Now, I read to you a passage from Ephesians where Paul said, slaves, obey your masters. But now I'm about to read you a passage where Paul is telling people to remain in the situation they were when they were first called to Christ, because he believes a time of persecution is coming. And he's absolutely right. A huge time of persecution did follow in the church shortly after that. But I'm reading now from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 21 through 22. Paul says, were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freeman. Similarly, he who was a freeman when he was called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Does Paul want us to become slaves of men? I don't think so. He says right here, do not become slaves of men. If you can gain your freedom, do so. Now, see, here's the issue. There was a peaceful way of freeing a slave. A master could choose to free a slave. They had a whole ceremony for it. This was slavery under the Romans. And Paul is encouraging people to do that if they possibly can. So it's obviously not an institution he believes in. He would obviously like to see the slaves free. That's obviously what he prefers. Now, does he want slaves to take up arms and get violent and turn Christianity into a bloodbath? That's another story, and I think that sheds some light on why in other places he would tell slaves to obey their masters. In other words, if it's a choice between starting a bloody revolution or just being peaceful and staying where you are, do that. But if they could be freed, he would want them to be free. Also, in the church, they recognize no social strata. The three big chief social stratas in those days were the Jews viewed themselves as being superior to Gentiles. Obviously, masters viewed themselves as being superior to slaves, and males viewed themselves as superior to females. It was a very male-dominated culture. That's another accusation that the Bible gets. The Bible's a chauvinistic book. No, the Bible is not a chauvinistic book. However, the Bible does come out of a chauvinistic culture. In Galatians 3:26, Paul's saying all these social distinctions have gone away. He says, you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. Now catch that. He's talking to men and women, and he's calling the men and women sons. Okay, he's not trying to do something that's neutering here. He's just saying that the lower class that you have in this society is a woman. You do not have in the church. You have the rights not only of a man, but a son and an heir. We'll talk more of that when we return. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others sadly do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services, 9 a.m. and 11 a.m.
Apostle Paul did not believe in slavery. One of the places where he says that is in Galatians chapter 3. You are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus, for all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourself with Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So in the church, they did not recognize anything superior about masters as opposed to slaves. They did not recognize anything superior about men as opposed to women. By calling them sons, in those days, if somebody owned an estate, that estate would go to his sons after he died. They would administer it, and especially to the firstborn son. And by calling men and women sons, by calling slaves and free sons, what he's saying is in Christ, you are all dignified human beings. You do not have any of these social divisions. Then in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, Paul says, we also know that the law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy and irreligious, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for adulterers, for perverts, for slave traders and liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to the sound doctrine. Did you catch that? On the list here of evils is a slave trader. Okay, so why would the Apostle Paul, who doesn't believe in slavery, tell slaves that they should obey their masters? I believe that we have a clue if we go to look at another apostle, Peter, in 1 Peter 2, 18 through 19. He says, slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh, for it is commendable if a man bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because he is conscious of God. And then he continues in chapter 3. And he says there are all kinds of institutions that we live under here in this world. Slavery is one of them. And living under the governor is another one. Living under the king is another. And he says, live as free men. He says, in Christ, you're free from all of these, but don't use your freedom as an excuse for rebellion. You need to understand that at that time, Rome had more slaves than citizens. If Peter, if Paul, if the other apostles, if Jesus had told the slaves to take up arms, Christianity would have historically been nothing but another revolution, a violent bloodbath. What Jesus wanted was a peaceful revolution. We saw this when they came and remember they tried to kind of test Jesus and they said to him, should we pay taxes? And he said, well, whose picture is that on the coin? They said, Caesar. He said, well, then give Caesar what is Caesar, give God what is God. They knew that the moment Jesus told the Jews not to pay their taxes to the Romans, he was declaring a revolution against Rome. Jesus was here to start a peaceful revolution, not a violent revolution. Now, that doesn't mean there's never a case for a violent revolution. I mentioned the Civil War earlier on the show. That was a violent freeing of the slaves that we need. But at this time in history, what Christianity is all about is changing hearts. Now, this same Apostle Paul wrote a fascinating letter. It's very brief. It's only one chapter, one of the shortest books in the Bible. It's called the Book of Philemon. And this is so interesting. I actually wrote a whole play about this. It was fiction based on history. But this is how much this fascinated me. Philemon owned a slave named Onesimus. Philemon converted to Christianity, and Onesimus, his slave, escaped. Now, we don't know when Philemon converted. He might have converted before Onesimus escaped, after Onesimus escaped. But Onesimus escaped, made his way to Rome, where Paul was under house arrest. And under Paul's influence, Paul led Onesimus, the slave, to Christ. At some other time, Paul had interaction with Philemon, and Philemon also had become a Christian. Now, what's going on is when Onesimus comes to Paul in Rome, Paul sends him back to Philemon, says to him, you need to go back and submit to your master. Okay, and I know that sounds horrible, but remember, he sends him back with a letter, and then he says to Philemon, here's your slave. I will pay for any financial loss you may have incurred. Please accept him back as a brother. He's yours, and you can do what you want with him. However, he says, I am confident you will do the right thing. In other words, wink, wink, nod, nod. Why don't you set them free? Let's review. Yes, there are places in the New Testament where it says slaves obey your masters, not because they condoned the practice, but because the practice was going on. And to say anything else was to encourage Christians to take up swords. They did not want Christianity to become a violent bloodbath. They did not want a violent revolution against Rome. They wanted a peaceful revolution to change his hearts. We know that they did not believe in slavery because in several places slavery is condemned. Paul called slave trading evil. Paul said to slaves, if you have an opportunity to gain your freedom peacefully, do so. And Paul said in the church, we do not even recognize a status such as masters and slaves. You want to call yourselves masters and slaves out in the world? You do what you want in the church. We do not recognize you that way. And a slave has all the same rights as anybody else. This was revolutionary stuff. This was stuff ahead of its time. But it's the kind of thing where they do one thing at a time. Now, what about the Old Testament? It's a little trickier with the Old Testament. In the New Testament, the ancient Hebrews did not hold slaves. They were living under the Romans. It was the Romans that held slaves. In the ancient Hebrew culture, where Moses gave us the commandments, we had what really wouldn't have been thought of as slavery. That could have been compared more to what we in America would call indentured servanthood. Now, you probably studied that in school. There were people who, for all intents and purposes, acted like slaves and worked like slaves, but they were not people that somebody had gone and caught in Africa and brought over here. These were people, some of them from Europe, who actually wanted to come to America, start a new life, buy some land. So they made a special arrangement, and I'll tell you that arrangement when we return. This is Bob Siegel. Buying or selling a home? Feeling overwhelmed? Facing what seems like unlimited choices? Believe me, your first and most important step is to find the right person to represent you and look out for your interests. Somebody who will help you save money while buying or make money for you when you sell. So listen carefully as I offer the best housing advice you're ever going to hear. What you want to do is contact Realty Executives All Area, and you want to ask for my good friend, Fred Falduti. Fred has managed literally hundreds of real estate transactions in the San Diego area and has handled just about any scenario you can imagine. Believe me, folks, you don't want to navigate the landmines of this economy without a skilled and experienced guide. But Fred is so much more. He will look after your interests as if they were his own. Give him a call or contact him online. Fred Falduti with Realty Executives All Area. 619-719-7717. That's 619-719-7717 or fredfalduti.com.
Reader enthusiasm for the dangerous Christmas ornament doesn't end. Check out this customer review from Amazon.com. Anytime I read a book where I want to find out what happens in the next chapter all the way to the last page of the book is a great book. This is the experience you and your children will have reading The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. I read the whole thing in a short time despite a busy schedule. The interesting plot lines has the flavor of realism because the author is writing from his own childhood experiences and ours as well. You will relate to the authentic family dynamics and the playground trials and triumphs described in the book. The book will also make you laugh as some of the characters have a great sense of humor, delivering good-natured jokes mixed with a dose of sarcasm. Most importantly, the book throughout has a moral dimension to it that takes it to a deeper level, making it a preferred selection to read to your kids. Enjoy The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available in bookstores and libraries.
We'll be right back.
back to the Bob Siegel Show. We just got finished talking about the New Testament and slavery. We're moving into the Old Testament. And I mentioned before we went to the break that the Old Testament could be more likened to what we would call indentured servitude here in the United States. You might have had somebody from Europe who wanted to come to the United States, start a new life, but they were poor. So somebody that maybe owned a plantation or a farm would pay their passage. And what they would do is work their passage off. But if they changed their mind, said, I don't want to work the passage off, well, that was breaking the law. So for all intents and purposes, you could say they were like a slave, but that was a situation that they voluntarily chose to go into. It was a financial contract. Now, something very much like that was going on with the ancient Hebrews. They did not think of it as slavery the way we would think of slavery. It was more like an employee, a situation of indentured servanthood. Somebody would sometimes come into debt in ancient Israel. It could happen for different reasons, bad crops, natural disasters. One could voluntarily sell, quote unquote, sell himself into a kind of contract agreement. Leviticus chapter 25 talks about one of your countrymen becoming poor and selling himself. A wife or children could be sold to help the family survive through tough economic times. Now, I want to point out right away that kinfolk could then go and redeem them and pay off their debt. But either way, they were only, it's interesting how much God mitigated this, because people were only allowed to keep such people in debt for 6 years. And even if that debt hadn't been paid off at the seventh year, this was known as the sabbatical year, that debt had to be paid off. And then every 50 years, they had what was called the year of Jubilee. Such people then could not be taken advantage of, and they weren't allowed to charge interest for it. I'm reading here from Leviticus 25. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and is unable to support himself among you, help him as you would an alien or a temporary resident so that he can continue to live among you. Do not take interest of any kind from him, but fear your God so that your countrymen may continue to live among you. You must not lend him money at interest or sell him food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. If one of your countrymen becomes poor among you and sells himself to you, do not make him work as a slave. He is to be treated as a hired worker or a temporary resident among you. He is to work for you until the year of Jubilee. Then he and his children are to be released, and he will go back to his own clan and to the property of his forefathers. And the employer could not be ruthless. He says, you must not rule over your fellow Israelites ruthlessly. That's Leviticus 25 also. Now, with people from other nations, it was a little bit different. We'll talk about that in a moment. Meanwhile, if somebody in this situation came to the sixth year, but he loved his employer and the family and wanted to stay, well, then that was another matter. They could stay in those cases. Masters were to grant their servants release every seventh year with all debts forgiven. It says, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. I know I just read you something like that from Leviticus, but I wanted to reinforce it again. Here I'm reading from Exodus 21. And a slave or servant's legal status was unique in the ancient Near East. In fact, I'm using the word slave very roughly. The Hebrew has no vocabulary of the word slavery, only servanthood. The word is hamash. So there was dignity given to these servants in Israel. They could choose to stay in this situation beyond the 6 years if they wanted to, and then they would declare their allegiance to serving that family the rest of their lives. But that was a choice they made. If not, once again, they were released every 7 years. That shows that a necessary way of dealing with poverty was being tempered with mercy. Once a master freed a servant, that person had full rights of an Israelite. From his servant obligations, the former servant had the status of full and unencumbered citizenship. Meanwhile, the law of Moses sought to prevent indentured servanthood as much as possible. Poor people could glean from the edges of fields or pick fruit from trees after harvest. This might prevent them from having to go and sell themselves as an indentured servant. God commanded Israelites to lend freely to the poor and to not charge them any interest once again. And when the poor could not afford sacrificial animals, they were allowed to sacrifice smaller, less expensive ones. In Genesis 1:26-27, it says, all humans are in the image of God, And that is the first book of the Law of Moses. And Job, the book of Job, says master and slave alike come from the mother's womb and are really equals. They also had in ancient Israel anti-harm laws. Injured servants were to be released, according to Exodus 21. When an employer accidentally gouged out the eye or knocked the tooth, or if he got violent with his slave, then this was against the law. If his slave died, the owner could actually be put to death. Again, I'm using the word slave as a kind of a conventional reference point. The word they actually used again there was servant. There were anti-kidnapping laws. Kidnapping for the purpose of selling somebody into slavery was punishable by death. They had anti-return laws, safe passage offered to runaway slaves from other countries. I'm reading here from an Old Testament scholar named Christopher Wright. He says, no other ancient Near Eastern law has been found that holds a master to account for the treatment of his own slaves as distinct from injury done to the slave of another master. And of the otherwise universal law regarding runaway slaves was that they must be sent back with severe penalties for those who failed to comply. We're also told, I'm reading here from Exodus 21, if a man strikes his male servant or his female servant with a staff so that he or she dies as a result of a blow, he will surely be punished. However, if the injured servant survives 1 or 2 days, the owner will not be punished, for he has suffered loss. What about leaving a wife or children behind? In Exodus 21, it says, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year, he will go out free without paying anything that we've already seen. But they've got more here. If he came in by himself, he will go out by himself. If he had a wife when he came in, then his wife will go out with him. If his master gave him a wife and she bore sons or daughters, the wife and the children will belong to her master and he will go out by himself. But if the servant should declare, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master must bring him to the judges and he will bring him to the door of the doorpost and his master will pierce his ear with an awl and he shall serve him forever. All right, so what they were talking about there was not slavery as we would understand it. That was indentured servanthood. It may still sound harsh by our standards, but it's not the kind of slavery that was going on in ancient Rome or in colonial America. There was another kind of slavery in ancient Israel, though, and that was people that were prisoners of war. But these were enemies of Israel. The alternative was to put them to death or to be merciful and find a way for them to live out their lives, but they couldn't roam free. They were enemies. See the difference? Of course you do. And I will see you next week.